you'd like to have your mother or your sister or your brother or your aunt or someone die? Because there isn't a road that's 11 miles long.
Another attempt to build the King Cove Road moves to Congress. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 3rd. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, tensions rise between a Native Village corporation in Sitka and its shareholders.
It's not a corporation to me. You know, it's not a business to me. It represents my legacy. As a Tlingit man, it's my responsibility to pass it to my descendants.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
President Trump wants to privatize air traffic control across the country, but the U.S.'s Senate Commerce Committee passed an aviation bill last week that does not include privatization. Committee Chairman John Thune, a South Dakota Republican, says he's not convinced.
I remain open-minded about the idea of moving the FAA's ATC function into a not-for-profit, non-governmental body, but I also appreciate that sincerely held concerns exist.
The Commerce Committee's moved the bill, but did not take a separate vote on privatization. Senator Dan Sullivan, a member of the committee, told Thune he was thankful for a different program in the aviation bill, the continuance of essential air service.
This is something that, as you know, is very important to rural states like mine.
Essential air service is a subsidy that brings down the cost of flights to rural communities. In Alaska, airlines get $21 million to fly 61 routes. The Trump administration has proposed eliminating funds for the program. The House version of the bill also continues essential air service. Unlike the Senate bill, though, the House one would transfer air traffic control to a nonprofit corporation. Most major airlines are promoting privatization, but general aviation groups are skeptical. They're concerned about user fees and say the new corporation could be controlled by the airline industry. If both bills pass as is, a conference committee will have to work out the differences. A new bill to create a road for King Cove is advancing in the U.S. House. Like many before it, this bill would authorize a land trade to acquire an 11-mile corridor through Izembek National Wildlife Refuge in southwest Alaska. Congressman Don Young told his colleagues on the House Natural Resources Committee the road would save lives by connecting King Cove to the all-weather airport in Cold Bay when there's a medical emergency.
Put yourself in that position as you sit here, might vote yes. If you'd like to have your mother or your sister or your brother or your aunt or someone die, because there isn't a road, it's 11 miles long.
The bill authorizes an equal value trade for the 206-acre corridor, more than half of which is designated as wilderness, the category of highest federal protection. In exchange for the corridor, the refuge could get up to 43,000 acres of state land. Democratic Congressman Raul Grijalva said a road could harm an estuary important to several species of migratory birds. Grijalva of Arizona said the bill would bypass the National Environmental Policy Act and ignore the exhaustive environmental review conducted during the Obama administration. Former Interior Secretary Sally Jewell rejected a land trade for the road in 2013, saying it would cause irreversible damage to the refuge. President Trump's Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, has already issued a permit for a study where the road should go. Young's bill passed the House Resources Committee last week by a party-line vote of 23-14. Congress is now on recess until July 9th in honor of Independence Day, but some members are looking ahead and asking to cancel their August break. Alaska's Dan Sullivan is among a group of 10 Republican senators who have asked Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to cancel or at least curtail the traditional month-long August break so they can make headway on conservative goals. The senators cite the need to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, fund the government, deal with the debt ceiling, pass a budget resolution, and reform the tax code. The lead on the letter was Senator David Perdue of Georgia, and all of the signers are in their first term except for Senator Mike Lee of Utah. The senators sent their letter Friday. The same day, a dozen members of the Conservative Freedom Caucus in the House sent a similar letter to House Speaker Paul Ryan. Governor Bill Walker signed the state operating budget on Friday without vetoing any of it. The portion of the budget directly controlled by the legislature includes $5 billion. It decreases funding for governmental agencies by roughly $150 million, while increasing funding for state retirement payments and debt service. The budget includes money for permanent fund dividends of $1,100. Walker thanked the legislature for avoiding a government shutdown, but he says the job is not complete. The budget closed a $2.5 billion gap between what the government spends and what it gets in taxes, fees, and oil royalties by using state savings from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. And a story we aired Friday on Alaska News Nightly included outdated information about the municipal workers' strike in Wrangell. In fact, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and Wrangell Borough officials returned to the bargaining table last Thursday, ultimately leading the 24 striking workers to head back to their jobs. IBEW leader David Reeves says the union emailed Wrangell Borough officials June 28th, asking for negotiations to resume.
We'd be willing to put the unfair labor practice hold it in abeyance, which basically means it would be paused and put on hold if they were willing to come back and talk.
The municipality agreed. Interim borough manager Carol Rushmore confirms that striking workers are back on the job. Union members went on strike June 22nd after the union and the municipality rejected each other's final contract offers. The main difference between the two sides is a wage increase. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, unmasking the invisible disabilities created by brain injuries.
I did not know what was going on. I just knew that I was failing in jobs that I shouldn't have failed in.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
There was a funeral service in the village of Northway Friday for a man shot by police in Fairbanks earlier this month. 21-year-old Matthew Colton Stover of Northway died in a confrontation with Fairbanks Police Department officers in a field next to the Fairbanks Correctional Center on June 19th. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, questions remain about Stover's motivation and what happened with police.
Fairbanks police say Matthew Stover fired first at officers who went to the area after receiving a report of a masked man with a rifle in the parking lot of a nearby Denny's restaurant. Police also reported that Stover was dressed in military-style armored clothing, had an assault rifle, a 9mm pistol, and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. Though she lives in Kansas, Matthew Stover's mother, Diana Stover, says she kept in regular contact with her son and that there was no indication of trouble.
I can't think of anything that could possibly cause him to do what the cops claim that he did. He was in a good state of mind. He was always happy and making everybody laugh. I'm very shocked that this whole situation even happened.
Matthew Stover did not have a criminal record, and Diana Stover says he was not involved in drugs, did not have any mental health issues, and seemed happy before the May 19th incident.
His friend told me the day before that he was in really good spirits, laughing, and nothing at all would have he saw that would have set him off.
She says Matthew grew up with her in Kansas, but moved to Northway at 18 to live with his father's side of the family, and had worked for Doyon Drilling on the North Slope for the last 3 years. She underscores that the June 19th incident was out of character for the boy she raised.
So this story the police are telling us, I don't buy it one bit at all. I think there's more to it, and we are going to request a look at surveillance cameras.
Diana Stover suspects cameras at Fairbanks Correctional Center may have captured video of the confrontation. She says she's heard of at least one person at FCC who witnessed the incident and offers a different account of what happened in the field next door.
That Matthew did not fire at the police and that he shot in the air.
It's unclear if the jail somehow played into Stover's actions. Fairbanks police spokeswoman Yumi McCulloch says police have nothing additional to release about the case, but that an investigation continues.
Detective
officers are talking to family and friends and anybody who knows anything about Mr. Stover and what happened early that morning. So we're asking for the public to, if they know anything, to let us know. We are looking to talk to the gentleman or the woman that contacted the Denny's restaurant employee, who then in turn called 911 to get some more information from that person.
McCulloch says once the police investigation is completed, the State Office of Special Prosecutions will review the case to determine if the actions of the four officers involved in the shooting were lawful. The officers have returned to duty. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Tension between a Native Village corporation and its shareholders has reached a boiling point. Shattuck called Sitka police to their annual meeting in May, saying threats had been made against staff and the board. But shareholders have a different story, one of raising their voices against a corporation in financial freefall. KCW's Emily Kwong reports on a growing movement by shareholders to challenge Shattuck's leadership.
Shattuck has 3,000 shareholders, and Christine Silvanio is one of them. She flew all the way from New Jersey to attend this annual meeting, but was asked to leave when two staff members noticed she was live streaming the gathering over Facebook.
So basically, they both threatened to have me escorted out.
How do you interpret these actions?
I interpret it as they're hiding something.
This is Margaret Carlson, who lives in Sitka. We're huddled outside the front door of Allen Hall as the rain pours and shareholders mill about. There are three board members up for re-election, and, Carlson says, a grassroots movement to vote them out.
It's time for a change, and all they've done was take our corporation down millions of dollars.
Much of it under the tenure of CEO Ken Cameron, who is also the president and the board chair. He was hired in 2010 when total revenue was at $180 million. As of the last annual report in 2015, Shattuck's revenue had plummeted to $3 million. Now, to bring Shattuck back into the black, the corporation is selling thousands of acres of its land in Cube Cove to the Forest Service. Mike Kinville, a shareholder based in North Pole, is worried the corporation is on a path towards landlessness and bankruptcy.
It's not a corporation to me. You know, it's not a business to me. It represents my legacy. As a Clinkett man, it's my responsibility to pass it to my descendants. But when I see it being run like this, and if you look at the financials, you can see that it's failing.
But it's not just Shattuck's business strategy that's raising tempers. It's also how they're treating their shareholders. The morning of the meeting, a huge wave of people showed up, filing past those two police officers that Shattuck called to hand in their proxies. The polls closed, and the board then went into recess for 3 hours to count votes, refusing to take questions like in the past. This left the roughly 200 shareholders there, many of them elders, waiting and frustrated.
We just went home after all of this. I was too upset to stay around.
David Kanosh is blind. His mother Eloise is leading them both back into the building.
When you can't see where you're going, and nobody's helping you. You know, this is disabled abuse. This is elder abuse.
Shattuck did not return KCAW's requests for comment after this meeting, but later published a statement on their website saying they didn't intend to mistreat anyone and just needed time to count votes. They called police out of concern, claiming threats had been made in the past.
There were some folks in there that were concerned.
Both sides, it seemed, had their defenses up. Shattuck stonewalling any attempt by shareholders to speak and shareholders voicing their outrage at will. When I was standing in the entryway at the invitation of shareholders, the corporation's lawyer, his name is Bruce Edwards, said no press are allowed in the building.
If you want to talk to him out there or take pictures out there, that's fine.
And he, along with staff, shut the door.
You guys are ridiculous, you know that.
Carlson and Silviano, she's the one who was live streaming, were pretty upset.
This is how they treat us.
This is what we're coming up against.
This is how they treat the shareholders.
And it's especially hurtful given the history. Corporations like Shattuck were founded to protect the rights and sovereignty of Alaska Natives, from the oldest shareholder to the youngest.
I got cold.
Say, I'm Bunny Blackbird.
I'm Bunny Blackbait.
Her mom, Martina Dundas, is a partial shareholder, born after the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was signed in 1971. And the way the corporation is going, she's worried her daughter is going to inherit nothing.
She got on the microphone in there after they adjourned for the first intermission. And she said, I want Shattuck to be saved. And she said, amen. And how many people in there, they had tears in their eyes as they said amen as well. So I don't want this corporation to go away. I want it to be a legacy of my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren.
From inside, we hear that the independent movement just got a break. Enough votes to unseat Shirley Yoakum, a board director for 30 years, with newcomer Lawrence Garrity. Dundas lets out a big exhale. Finally, she says, it seems like we have somebody that has our interests.
What are you going to tell your daughter when she asks, Mommy, what happened?
I'm going to say that we're starting to get all the ducks lined up to be able to provide for her.
The meeting is over. The board is now about to convene behind closed doors. I catch Garrity on his way there. He hopes his election will send a message to Shattucka.
You know, in 9 days, we got 98,000 votes. In 3 weeks, they got 90. They need to listen to our elders, listen to our people.
It's hard to say whether Shattucka took that message to heart. That day, the board reelected Cameron as chair. Their next meeting is in July. Meanwhile, the independent group is not backing down. Calling themselves shareholders for Shattucka's future, they're raising money. There's been bake sales and silent auctions, all to support more independent representation and attempt to remove Cameron entirely. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks has embarked on a new comprehensive ocean ecosystem study of the Bering and Chukchi Seas. For 3 weeks in June, the crew of the research vessel Sekuliak collected preliminary data through observations of marine mammals, birds, weather conditions, and much more. Seth Danielson is an associate professor with the University of Alaska Fairbanks College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences and was aboard the Sekuliak. He says the study focuses on how climate change could affect everything in the ocean, all the way down to the smallest organisms.
We're trying to get a handle on what our ocean looks like out here, what the ecosystem looks like, how it's working, how it's functioning, and hopefully put ourselves in a better position to be able to anticipate what this ecosystem really could be looking like 10 and 20 years down the road from now.
Danielson says the research team worked hard during more than 3,000 mile journey while running on minimal amounts of sleep.
Collecting up to 6,500 liters of water for Russ Hopcroft and his team, who got to lug all of those around from one end of the deck to the other. They dredged up 45,000 baby clams, measured and counted very precisely.
According to Danielson, it's been 30 years since a study of this magnitude has taken place in the northern Bering and Chukchi Seas. Going forward, more data will be collected on sea temperatures in these areas, then released in comprehensive reports and publications. Danielson expects their full findings won't be available for about 5 more years. Last month, the Alaska Division of Agriculture received a $100,000 federal grant to strengthen its farm-to-school program. That's an effort to get locally sourced food into schools. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
How can schools in the Bristol Bay region put more locally sourced food on cafeteria trays? That's the question farm-to-school coordinator Jody Anderson is asking. The recent grant from the USDA will fund her position and travel in the region for 2 years. Grassroots is the word that she most often uses to describe the project. She wants to begin with a needs assessment. That means meeting with gardeners, farmers, and schools starting this fall to understand networks for local food supply and demand.
One of the things that I really want to do through this is develop kind of a regional specific source book just to gather people together who are growing food to see where food is happening, where it's growing, who's doing it, and then how can we connect each other to those growers so that we can get it to the schools.
By cultivating this network, Anderson hopes to put more local food in area schools by fall of 2018. This first phase will focus on Dillingham City School District, Bristol Bay Borough School District, Southwest Region School District, and the Lakeham Peninsula School District.
The cool thing is that it's going to be based on the needs of the communities and not a top-down approach where I'm saying this is what has to happen or USDA is saying it has to go this way. It's here's some money, let's figure it out, and then let's build it to fit the need that we have.
The idea is that Bristol Bay will be a pilot region and that Anderson will develop a toolkit for other areas to use to increase the consumption of local food in their schools. The second phase of the project will be to identify a second rural region and put that toolkit to work.
Every place has its own issues and its own challenges and opportunities. What we're hoping to do with the Bristol Bay region is to document and show a process and to actually use the process model as something that can be done anywhere in the state of Alaska.
Anderson chose Bristol Bay as a jumping-off point because she's already spent time in the area. She taught a gardening symposium for several years through the University of Alaska Fairbanks Bristol Bay campus and the Bristol Bay Native Association. In this region and around the state, she sees several reasons that convince her schools should aim to source more locally produced food.
The great news about buying local is that the money that you're spending stays local. The education component, when students learn where their food comes from, they're more willing to try foods. And then the third component is nutrition education. When we're able to harvest something and get it onto a student's plate within a couple days versus a couple of weeks, there's a huge nutritional difference.
Victoria Briggs, who farms in Ugashik, is involved helping Anderson make connections with local schools and growers. She also advocates to state legislators for local food in schools through the nonprofit Alaska Food Policy Council. She says many schools in the area are already interested in sourcing local produce. Dillingham City School District, the Lakeham Peninsula School District, and the Bristol Bay Borough School District already buy some of their vegetables locally. Briggs sees the state assistance through Farm to School as taking some of the burden off school administrators to locate growers on their own.
So the state has in the past been able to open the doors with that. And for me, the Farm to School is to, yes, get food into the schools. But part of what comes from this is just the realization in our communities that we can produce and that we can supply these things locally to any of the establishments that are there.
The USDA also awarded grants to 17 other state agencies for the Farm to School program. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
An Anchorage woman has started a series of mask-making events to help people understand the challenges of brain injuries. Unmasking Brain Injuries is a new project that lets people with cognitive disabilities from brain trauma share their experience through art. Alaska Public Media's Henry Leisha went to learn what these masks reveal.
On a recent afternoon, seven people are using colorful paints, feathers, strings, and beads to decorate masks inside Access Alaska, a support center for people with disabilities. Retired Air Force Sergeant John Main is busy sketching designs. He's methodical, coordinating colors with a list of emotions written on a separate sheet of paper. Like everyone else at this event, Main suffers from a brain injury. In 2011, he had a stroke, but it was undiagnosed for years.
I didn't have slurred speech, I didn't have a weakness anywhere, so they didn't think I really had a stroke. Well, what they didn't realize, I'd had a stroke, but it affected something different than my muscles and that. It affected my cognitive reasoning, my analytical abilities.
When it comes to brain injuries, appearances can be deceiving. Robert Barnett, a brain injury survivor who works at Access Alaska, says there's a disconnect between the internal experience of a cognitive disability and what it looks like to an outside observer.
It takes me a while to even understand people's disabilities because they're invisible.
Many survivors feel like they have to put on a disguise to face the world, and that's exactly what the Unmasking Brain Injury Project hopes to address. The idea came from Hinds Feet Farm, a nonprofit based in North Carolina. More and more people started getting involved as the masks were displayed around the country. Annette Alfonsi of Anchorage first heard about the project from a friend in another state. Having suffered a brain injury herself, she requested materials to make her own mask and eventually became a coordinator for the project in Alaska. She hopes that the masks, although unique to each maker, will bring them together.
Folks, especially across Alaska, can feel very alone if they don't know folks in their immediate area that have that kind of brain injury. So this is a really great way to raise awareness.
Two studies from 1999 and 2008 estimate that there are between 3 and 5 million brain injury survivors now living with a disability in the United States. However, these figures are limited to administrative data from hospitalizations and emergency room visits, which isn't the full picture. A lack of awareness can make it difficult for people to find care. While there are a few resources in Alaska, Alfonsi says it was difficult to figure out what options were available for her.
If you're navigating that system by yourself, you don't have any experience with it, and then you don't have the ability to kind of be proactive about it because your symptoms kind of lead to being isolated and feeling kind of alone or quiet and in the dark.
When John Main finishes the design for his mask, he has divided it into sections that represent different stages of his life. The left side of the mask is a pale pink that represents life before his brain injury. The middle section of the mask is darkly shaded and chaotic, illustrating the uncertainty of the years when his stroke was undiagnosed.
I see future, where before I seen hopelessness. You know, I did not know what was going on. I just knew that I was failing in jobs that I shouldn't have failed in.
But on the right side of the mask, Main colors pink for the support he has received since his stroke was diagnosed, and green for the bright future he sees ahead of him. Currently, Alfonsi is preparing mask displays for exhibits at the end of this year. To learn more about the project and see photos of the masks, visit alaskapublic.org. In Anchorage, I'm Henry Leisha.
And a correction from a story we ran last week about the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association's syringe exchange program. We reported that half the program's budget went to incinerating used needles. In fact, that amount is much lower, less than $3,000 per year. That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Davis Hovey in Nome, and Henry Leisha in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Ann Hillman produced tonight's show. And I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on July 6th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the National Guard Armory in Fairbanks. The event is open to all. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.